Okay, we're recording.
I am a little bit worried that, like, you just summarized it as, like, oh, these people claim to be rational, but, like, actually, they're actually just following the beliefs of this guy. And, like...
What I do, so you know... I mean... I think you kind of underestimate, you know, your importance and the importance of this community in the grand scheme of things. Like the piece that hopefully will publish at the Times here pretty soon, you know, it just says very simply that you have this community here that most people don't know about has become enormously influential. These ideas, and you have worked their way into the tech industry, and these companies that are building this very important technology.
Yeah.
And the world is now having to grapple with these ideas, right? And the ideas are, part of it's, rational thought, let's call it, but then, transhumanism. And as Scott Alexander says in that blog post, there are other people who believe in rationality. There are other people who believe in transhumanism. There are other people who believe AI is a danger. But this community has fed all that into the industry. And you can show this very easily.
Yeah.
That's
true.
And it's through a lot of my reporting, where Yudkowsky introduces Peter Thiel to the DeepMind guys, and his thinking, and the thinking of a lot of people in his circle was instrumental in the creation of OpenAI. And
to their deep regret.
Yeah, but they're like. We can talk about, there's another side that we can talk about that later, but also the creation of Anthropic, and it continues to drive the thinking of Anthropic, and the community is deeply entwined with Anthropic, and there's this MATS program that is held at Lighthaven, and they're feeding people into the company.
I was actually just reading, before you walked up here, I was reading a comment from Nostal Gebreyes responding to Evan Hubinger, who is the leads, I think it's the alignment stress testing team in Anthropic. And, to me, this is normal, but to someone who thinks more in terms of institutions than random internet blog weirdos might find this kind of surprising, because Nostal Gebreyes is the pseudonym of, I don't know what this person's day job is, if they even have a day job. And Evan Hubinger is actually works for Anthropic, which is the tech company that you've heard of.
Right. You call the internet weirdos? We call it something nicer, the rationalist community, slash EA community, or whatever you want to call it. It is this giant force in that world that in some ways has more power than the companies.
We wish.
It's a different power, but it's power.
And
nobody knows about it.
Right.
Nobody knows about it. And so what I'm doing is I am explaining this to people and showing how this happened. Where did this community come from? How did these ideas evolve?
And that's what the book is about?
And it's exactly what the book is
These
ideas, right? Where did they come from? And how did they evolve? And how did they kind of move from person to person? Because these are powerful ideas. Does that make sense?
Do you have a title?
I have a title, but I've written almost all of it now, and that's what it does. It shows. It shows the evolution of these ideas, and then how they move from kind of important person.
We've mentioned criticisms of you in the past, and I want to distinguish between two different types of criticisms. Because there's some people who are saying Cade Metz is such a meanie, reveal and bully, revealing Scott Alexander's name, and I think you don't take that very seriously. Whereas, like, there, I want to, like, set that aside and also focus on the people. Like, just, there are separately people who are, like, who have talked to you and who have, like, read your work, who are saying, like, this is, like, kind of, like, gossip column-y coverage that's, like, not focused on the ideas and more focused on, like, powerful people and their relationships to each other. And I don't know, maybe you're doing that on purpose, but it just seems like...
Like, what's an example?
So, like, my friend Ben Hoffman mentioned that he talked to you. How do you remember that conversation?
Oh, I guess... I thought he was seriously going to talk to me. Now I think he was never going to talk to me.
Well, no, I think he would have if you were, like, a different kind... If you... So, he described it on his blog as... I mean, maybe you want to just read these paragraphs? Or I can just send it to you later. But just, like...
What did he say?
When Metz reached out to me in the process of working on a book on the idea of general intelligence, I formed the same independent impression. If I asked him about his interest in the topic, his perception of my relevance, etc., the answer was entirely in terms of social reality. What was really striking about this was the perfect serenity with which he was enacting a pseudo-perspective which functionally constitutes total and perfect aggression against anyone who cares about anything. I didn't think it was worth my time to proceed. End quote. So...
So, that doesn't surprise me.
Uh-huh.
So many people in this is not rocket science. People in that circle don't view the world the way I do.
Yeah.
I view it differently.
Right.
Right? And I'm trying to take what's going on in that world
and
convey it to the layperson.
Yeah, I'm just...
That's fundamentally going to be different. Then, like the writing that I do, is completely different from your memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different.
Right.
The layperson cannot comprehend your memoir. Like,
right.
They just can't because you think differently.
Right.
Maybe you think better, or maybe you know that's a better way to think about the world. But the people don't think that way.
Right.
But so, yeah, I'm taking all this stuff, and I'm conveying it in a completely different way, and if Ben doesn't, you know, like that, that's fine. But
like, there's this. But like, does the completely like so? I definitely agree that like, you're writing a book for the general public. You can't just. Do a raw thought dump of what the people you're covering think because they're not speaking the same language as the general public. But you can.
Where he's wrong is I care deeply about the ideas. And this is why I'm talking to you.
Okay.
So this is why this is so interesting.
Okay.
And why your diary was so interesting.
Uh-huh.
Because what the diary showed
mm-hmm.
are the ideas that people were thinking about at that time.
Yeah.
Right? And I love there's this moment where. You sort of go back to the group house after the meetup.
Yeah.
And you know, you're talking about like it's the overcoming bias community and the topic on the table is, you know, rationality and bias and that. But it goes towards this transhumanism stuff. It shows that was just part of it, right?
Yeah.
And I want to explain the idea of transhumanism to people.
Mm-hmm.
I want to explain the idea of rational thought to people.
Mm-hmm.
I want to explain why these things intersect in this community.
Mm-hmm.
I want to explain all that through the people
mm-hmm.
and through the things that happen to them.
Okay.
Right?
Do I get to read excerpts of the book? Like, I know for the article, like, I know the Times has a policy against that, but, does that apply to the book?
What I will do
okay.
is I will tell you exactly what the facts are that would be in it. Like, you know, it will say that you did this on this day, and you said this.
Okay, so fact-checking.
We'll get on the phone, and I will fact-check it all.
Because all right, but like, again, like, there was the thing with, like, the thing with Kelsey Piper where, like, you fact-checked, like, the exact quote, and, like, the exact quote was, like, not, very clearly not what she meant. Yeah.
I had to boil down what she said.
Yeah.
To plain English. And I...
Yeah, it didn't work.
It did work.
No, it didn't.
How would you describe what she said? That's what she said. She said to me,
oh,
is, you know, I said, there are a lot of people who see Scott this way, and there are a lot of other people who see Scott that way, and I'm going to represent both views. And so she said, you know, what you really need to do is find a way of statistically.
No, a terrible paraphrase. So, like, here, let me bring up my... Because, you know, in my interview with you, like, I included, like, a little editor's note of, like, what Kelsey actually said to me afterwards. And, like, that wasn't very many words.
Is that necessarily what she said to me?
No, so, like, without casting blame, without, you know, maybe it was her fault for, like, giving a bad interview and not pushing back enough during the fact check call. But, like, separately of whether how much of it is your fault and how much of it is Kelsey's fault, like, the thing that was actually printed in the New York Times was not a good paraphrase of Kelsey's views, as I understand them. And so, like... I mean, editor's note, when reached for comment, Piper said that she told Metz that she wasn't a huge fan of both sides journalism, where you just find someone with one opinion and someone with... I mean, I don't have to read this whole quote, but, like, I wrote, like, I have this paragraph of, what Kelsey said to me afterwards, and then, like, people who read my interview on Twitter were, like, kind of making fun of you for, like...
Of course they
yeah,
are.
But, like, I think they had a point, is what I'm saying. Like, I think they were in the right there.
Well, I think that there are plenty of people.
Well, yeah, but like you
didn't talk to one person,
right?
All sorts of people.
Well, so, but like this is the same thing that Ben is talking. Like, but.
Well,
like there's. What makes an article good reporting? Fairness. What's fairness if all sides get the chance to defend themselves? Absolutely zero recognition of any underlying reality about which an accusation might be made or communication attempted. So there's this thing where, like, if you're just, like, counting heads of, like, these people say this thing, but on the other hand, these people say this thing, and you don't, like, you're still in what we would call, like, social reality, where you're, like, talking about people and what they think. And, like, there's a separate, like, layer underneath social reality where, like, you investigate things yourself. And there's, like, kind of this awkward, like, recursive thing where, like... When you do investigate the things themselves yourself, and then, like... That ends up just being yet another perspective. And you could, like, enter that into the social discourse of Cade Metz thinks this and such. But, like, you do... If you just cover what... There are these different people, and here's what these different people think without, like, investigating things yourself and without, like, investigating the base reality that's not about what people think about, but just the things themselves, then you're kind of ungrounded.
I see what you're saying, and that's sort of the fundamental belief in you, that you can have this absolute... Right, it gets around to, like, what you're saying is that the community come to this you know, come to this absolute truth,
mm-hmm.
And you got somebody who's saying, you know, who's saying actually we don't believe that,
mm-hmm.
We believe something else. Like, from my perspective,
mm-hmm.
can we really be sure what that absolute truth is? Like,
we can't be sure, but we can, like, try. We can do our best.
That's what I do.
Okay.
I really do my best. I just do it in a different way.
Okay. I'm just saying, like, okay, so I don't... I'm just saying, like, when we get to that fact-checking phase, I want to be, like, more diligent than Kelsey, because I don't, like... With respect, I don't trust you to get the story right. I'm happy to talk because out of the principle that I'm happy to talk to anyone, but like I don't have faith that you're going to get it right. So whatever you can, when we get to the fact checking phase, whatever you can show me, I'm going to be like watching like a hawk. Like, okay, okay.
So, what's so interesting to me is you, as you discover, mm-hmm. like, again, I just think that your story is so interesting because mm-hmm. you know, you kind of knew who Yudkowsky was, mm-hmm. mentioned him in your diary, mm-hmm. you read Great Mama Chicken, mm-hmm. really like it, mm-hmm. you're kind of intrigued by these. Kind of doing fact checking now. You're
yeah.
intrigued by these transhumanist ideas. You said that future tech is comforting.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's kind of like religion, but more real, more plausible.
Well, yeah.
More plausible is the word you use. I think I used that. And then you know you're reading that was it Joan Galt? Jane Galt.
Uh-huh.
Blog and she links to that Universe of Fire essay and you click on it and you read this thing and you know in my
yeah.
story then I explain to them that the Universe of Fire essay and that sort of captures your interest and mm-hmm. then you keep reading this stuff
mm-hmm.
and then you meet these people in person, mm-hmm. and that excites you to see that in your diary, and you get more and more into these ideas of rational thought. But also, as you show in your diary, you get into this idea of the singularity. You tell mm-hmm. people, I'm down with this too, right?
Yeah.
And but then you reach this moment mm-hmm. where you're comforted. Also,
mm-hmm.
by this notion that there is this fundamental truth,
mm-hmm.
And that includes this post from Yudkowsky where he says, men and women are fundamentally different, and you can't change, right? And,
uh-huh.
I go into that essay. Is
okay.
Like, well, no, but it's a way of showing these ideas, right?
And, okay.
And so your eyes are open by this.
Mm-hmm.
You do a good job of explaining it.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's like a temporary diary or it's an email you send to somebody where you say, "This is like
mm-hmm.
shocking slash etc. Right?
Uh-huh.
And there is this comfort for you in this moment where you feel like there is an absolute reality.
Well, I mean, I agree that there's an absolute reality, but, like, I wouldn't have quite phrased it like that. I mean, what I found so striking about that prose is just, like, it was very, very clear about something that I'd never seen any other author articulate so clearly, which is that, like, yeah, it's, you could fantasize about changing sex and you can write a fun science fiction story about it, but, like, he points out, like, look, there are lots of technical details that you would have to settle here.
The clarity
yeah.
was comforting to
me. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
The clarity was comforting. You had confusion and suddenly you had clarity. That's a great word.
I do use that word a lot, yeah.
It's a really good word. I don't know, and that, like, in some ways, it's a metaphor for, like, this whole movement. Like,
mm-hmm.
it gives people clarity.
Well,
you know?
But I mean, the thing that the whole memoir is about is, like, expressing rage and frustration that, like.
I haven't gotten there yet.
Okay.
That's what's so interesting. So, you, like a lot of people, get comfort from this clarity and this, you know, this very like cold, calculated way of viewing
the world.
You fast forward to 2016, everybody has the Facebook. And then he blows it all up. And then that clarity is lost in some ways, right?
Yeah.
You know, the comfort and the clarity is lost.
Well, so again, I don't like thinking in terms of comfort.
Well, tell me,
Well, because part of the reason like I dislike the word comfort almost as much as I like the word clarity is because like people often, I don't know if this is like a human universal or just in our society these days, but like people very often do this thing of like trying to shut down inquiries, shut down discussions on the grounds of like this makes people uncomfortable, and like.
Oh yeah, but that's a separate issue.
Yeah,
like this is about
right.
How you feel at the moment.
Yeah, but like the feeling is not one of comfort. The feeling is like it's.
Clear.
Yeah, but like clarity isn't comfort. It's not comfortable. It's like. Like in Paul Graham's writings, he has this. He says something about how like people who work at startups, as opposed to like big companies, like they seem more worried, but also more alive. And so it's more like that. It's not like being clear and like telling the truth, even when those truths are genuinely uncomfortable, like. It's not comforting, but it's like a more intense and vivid way to live. And
that's a good point.
Whereas delusions that flatter things that wouldn't it be nice if that were true, are often more comforting.
Clarity is much better. See?
Mm-hmm.
But then that clarity is threatened by this Facebook post.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what you feel in that moment when you read.
Well, at the time, I'm just like very confused. Like, wait, what? Like, what is he actually like? Clearly, this is hugely in tension with this thing that he wrote, 7 years ago. Like, what's going on?
Causes confusion.
Yeah.
And does the confusion continue? Like, how do things?
Yeah. So, like, there. I mean, so like as. I don't know, point of order, what is the point of, like, verbally talking through the thing that I already wrote down?
Because you've written something down
that
is several thousand words.
Okay, fair enough.
I have to paraphrase, like, with Kelsey Binder.
Yeah.
I have to boil it down.
Right.
So when we talk like this, it helps me boil it down.
All right.
Get to those important words, like...
Fair enough.
Like clarity, right? So...
Fair enough. I don't think you're very good at paraphrasing, but we'll try it.
I just think about it.
Okay.
I'm different at paraphrasing.
All right. But like that.
Because
that's way, speaking of comfort, that is not comforting. Okay. So yeah, this was there. Okay. So there was this period through 20, like that was like the first note of like, wait, what's going on here? And then through 2016, you know, I was like, you know, not, I was like, suddenly like, wait a minute. Like after the idea that like, wait, trans women are the same thing. Like, cause you know, he's clearly talking about guys like me, you know, 30% of the ones like I am obviously in that 30%. And so I suddenly like start talking to people I know in Berkeley, including a lot of trans women in Berkeley. And like suddenly being like, I can't. And there were a number of private conversations. I wrote what I could in that post where I like gradually just like, wait, like it became very clear to me that like a very large fraction of trans women are people, guys like me. And this was very surprising because before then I had assumed, I mean, if in the diary, like there's so many obvious hints in retrospect, but like in that diary from like, 7 years earlier, I had been like, you know, I wrote about, I don't know if you noticed that, it was just a few lines, but like, you know, I wrote about gender stuff, but I assumed that like my thing was not the same thing as being transgender, because everyone, because like my thing was obviously this autogynephilia thing, that was obviously a way more informative word than like gender identity, which like, what? And so like, and so like this was both surprising, and I thought like, you know, given the premise of like we are the rational thinkers, I thought more people would be interested in clarifying this in public, like, hey, a lot of like males, like this, there, because you know there's this, you know, in places like Berkeley there's this entrenched by now, but at the time like suddenly very popular like idea that like some, you know, some assigned male at birth people have this gender identity, and that makes them like the same relevantly the same sort of thing as cis women, and that is just like not my model at all.
What you're saying is that that is not the model that you think the rationalists have, but they do. Why do they have that model even though you think that they should?
Well, so but. Again, like, so this is the point where like the rationalists stop being good at abstraction. I think what happened, there was the thing, there was the, you know, very, very sexist thing that Yudkowsky said, you know, in 2009, when this was just a weird blog on the internet and there wasn't a lot of political pressure for him to say or believe otherwise. And then, you know, 7 years later, as the political incentives in society in general had shifted, and the his profile and the political pressures on him in particular had shifted. Like, that article he wrote in 2009 is not something he could have written in 2016.
So the political pressure is personal pressure that's getting to him and changing his
I mean, like, obviously, I'm not a mind reader. I can't know that for certain. But like, if you just look at like, here's what the guy said in 2009. Here's what the guy said in 2016. Like, it's like, what do you think happened, right?
Exactly. And this is why I feel like it's somewhat analogous to what I have seen, because I don't think the community can, you know, think objectively, if it ever could, about what I'm writing or what I'm doing, or it's like this. There are these pressures, social pressures, to think a certain way.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
In terms of people like preemptively dissing you because they want to signal allegiance to Scott Alexander. Yeah, that's definitely a thing. I agree. That's why I was trying to highlight like the thing. I think the thing that Ben Hoffman wrote about you was not doing that.
Right. Well, I don't know what's going on with Ben, but like Ben, when he talked to me, he's like, "Yeah, I'll talk for your book. That sounds great. Give me a call next week."
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, he never responded to me. And then the next thing I know, so I don't know what's going on there.
Well, so like Ben. I mean, like, Ben had... Sorry, I think I missed a sentence in there. You called... He said, call me next week, and then what happened?
And then he never responded, but I did call, right?
Okay. But you did get on the phone eventually, right?
What I mean is, we talked on the phone.
Uh-huh.
For a long time. I told him exactly what I was doing. He says, yes, that's something I would like to participate in.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk, you know. Next week, I can't do it right now.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't...
Mm.
Maybe.
Well, because in his blog post, he mentions, I didn't think it was worth my time to proceed.
Wait, don't
hear
me.
Okay.
In any event, the word you keep using in your memoirs, that they're fake. So why is it fake then?
I mean... See, this is, again, this is why I'm, like, reluctant. This is why, like, I'm, like, really...
No, but that, you've said it.
Yeah, I know.
Right,
so well, right, but, like...
I'm just trying to help you. I'm giving you a chance to explain.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
I think...
You have to.
Right, no. But it's just like, I want to contextualize that in the sense that, like, lots of things in society are fake in the same sense. School is fake. Work is, like, okay. There, in the, as someone who had read the sequences as they were being written, there was this, like, very, very, like, high standard being articulated of, like, we are going to pursue the truth, not just in the sense of, like, we're going to say literally true sentences, but, like, we are going to, like, use a cognitive algorithm that would have returned a different answer if reality had been different, which is a much higher standard than only using true sentences. For the same reason that, like, you know, politicians and used car salesmen are very, very good at not, at, like, getting people to believe and do what they want them to do and believe without technically lying. Because you just cherry pick, and a lot of journalists are good at this too, of, like, just cherry pick the particular facts that you want in order to weave the narrative that you want. And Yudkowsky's sequences had, like, articulated this like, much more ambitious vision of, like, holding oneself to a much, much higher standard than, like, we're not just going to not lie, we're actually going to, like, get the correct model. And then it turned out that, like, at least on some topics where getting the correct model would be perceived as political suicide, it turns out, like, okay, we're not actually going to do it on those topics. And I think that the disagreement with my other community members that's being expressed in this memoir is, like, for me at least, this kind of kills the whole project. Like, because, you know, I have this huge, huge, again, like, lots of people I know are, like, making these huge, huge social and medical decisions on the basis of information that I think is, like, just egregiously misleading. If the rationalist can't even get this one right, that's, like, actually personally relevant to us, like, what is even the point? And, like, I think from the perspective of the people I'm disagreeing with, they think that, like, well, you know, we will avoid politically sensitive topics, but that doesn't kill the whole project because we can just, like, carefully not lie and carefully avoid sensitive topics and, like, still focus on the thing that actually matters, which is AI risk. And, like, I can understand that and I can respect that in certain ways, but, like, I'm kind of mad about the misleading market. I go into this in part four a lot of, like, I think I do have a false advertising complaint. If you are going to follow the strategy, which I can understand in respect of, like, okay, we're not going to do heresies. We're not going to do thought crimes. We have more important things to focus on. Then you should not really be marketing yourselves as, like, we are the only sane and rational people in the world, because, like, on certain topics, like, there are other people who are facing less political pressure than you who are going to be better than you on those topics.
So I want to go into the really big thing. But first, when you say they're getting political pressure, like,
yeah,
specifically, what is that pressure and where is it coming from? Why do they have to bow to them?
I mean, because they're worried that someone will write a New York Times article insinuating that they're racist or sexist or transphobes. Which actually happened, by the way. I mean, I that wasn't your intent, but, like, that was...
I didn't say that, right?
Right.
What I pointed out is that...
Okay.
So they're worried about people...
They're worried about the thing that actually... Yeah.
Why are they worried?
I mean, if... I mean, in the early 2020s, we saw, like, in the late teens and early 2020s, you know, we saw that, like, cultural trend of cancellations, like, people, I mean, you live through these years, I don't feel like I should have to explain this.
So you're saying that because of that trend,
Yeah, so like the
you count the people around them are bowing to this because of that.
Yeah, I think so.
They're bowing to the external.
Yeah.
Cancellation.
Right? Yeah. So, because like remember the James Damore thing? Yeah, like they're and so like no one wants to be James Damore, right? And especially if you're like have this movement that like you think is like uniquely important for the entire future history of the world, you don't want the thing that happened to James Damore to happen to your project.
I got it. So I guess my question is, when you say the whole enterprise is called into question, and you have doubt over whether or not it can hang on to like the real truth in this one area.
Mm-hmm.
Does that reduce your confidence, their ability to hang on to the truth in other areas?
Like, yes. Yes. It does, but like the reason I'm still, it does reduce my confidence in other. However, and so like there's this from an outsider perspective, you might ask this natural follow up question of like, okay, so why are you still scared of AI, right? And the answer there is that like, my beliefs about AI as an extinction and existential risk are not solely based on deference. Like, I actually read the arguments, and I can actually check a lot of the arguments there and say, like, this part is still real.
Oh, I got you. But you've also told me in the past that, you know, you've said to me, like, you can't necessarily trust this group's opinions on the X risk.
Yeah.
You know, right?
I mean, well, so, I'm just in general, like, I don't... In general, like... I mean, I do think X-Risk is real. I do think the world should be paying much more attention to getting this stuff right. And I think like this community is the place where people are paying attention to it. But like, that doesn't mean you should just defer to what these people already think. It means you should like think for yourself and like take it. Like, I would love for like more people with more diverse backgrounds to like read this stuff and think about it for themselves instead of just like copy-pasting Yudkowsky's beliefs, which...
So ultimately, you still believe that there is this absolute truth?
Yes.
Do you get that some people really question?
I think they are confused about some things.
The other fascinating thing was when you talked about how it changed the way read something like Darwin.
Uh-huh.
So explain that to me.
Okay.
After this situation changed the way you read that. So explain that.
This is, I'm laughing because like this is exactly the reason that everyone's like, don't talk to Kate Metz, because like this is the part they don't want to talk about.
It's so interesting.
But like, I'm happy to talk to anyone.
Great.
Because like, so I had read Yarvin as, you know, writing as Moldbug, like, you know, back in the late aughts, and like, just because, you know, I read lots of things on the internet, and I just, you know, it was something I had read and like not taken very seriously. And then in light of suddenly, you know, everyone I trust are saying that guys like me can be women by means of saying so, which is just so transparently absurd. Like, Yarvin's model of like the political pressures and the asymmetry between left and right in the U.S. Like, I'm not nearly as much of a Yarvin scholar as a Yudkowsky scholar, so I don't think I can summarize the model briefly verbally. But like,
what you're saying is that model started to make sense to you.
Yeah, it started to seem much more credible in a way that previously I'd just been sort of like glanced at it and shrugged. Mm-hmm. Now I was looking at it and be like, wait a minute, there's definitely something real here.
That's really interesting. So basically that the political pressures can really get to people and
yeah.
sort of shape what society does.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting. So, can you explain to me why, you know, these communities at the very least are adjacent, like the neo-reactionary thing and the rationalist.
I mean, they're not that. They're a little bit adjacent.
Why does everybody talk about it? Well, precisely because.
So, like, the reason the rationalists are a target. So, the reason they're scared is because, like, precisely because we're so good at. We're, like, pretty good. Look at me. I'm using the first person again. We, they. Not sure which one is right. They're sufficiently good at free speech and free inquiry that they're willing to engage with this stuff at all. Whereas people, so like, I understand that for the New York Times piece, you talked to David Gerard a lot. Okay. Okay. But like, basically, like in our society, like people who like just work at a university, people who work at, you know, San Francisco State, are like not going to engage with far right thought at all. Like, just, it's just like unthinkable. But as internet weirdos, we're happy to think about anything. Like,
you're kind of determined to engage,
yeah, sure,
right?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, come, yeah, engage. Right?
Yeah.
It's like a badge of honor.
Yeah. And so like, me personally, I ended up actually like agreeing with parts of this, but like other people who are part of the community who like just read it and disagreed, like there's still this threat of like someone else could say, aha, you read the evil text. Even if you say you disagreed, like, you're still tainted.
I get it. But it's so interesting how there is this determination,
mm-hmm,
to engage. I think that's interesting, and that's all I'm saying. In that,
uh-huh,
it's like our codex piece. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
read the first section in part four, and I think I explained my issues.
I understand. Again, I think it boils down to, again, you know, you're kind of paraphrasing. Right? I gotta boil stuff down.
Yeah.
I have space. I've gotta. But I get it. We're on over that.
Okay.
But the other thing that's so interesting is the community's almost obsession with intelligence, whether,
yeah,
it's people or machines.
Yes.
There's this moment.
That's definitely real.
Where does that come from? Like,
I mean, I've kind of always been this way.
Sure.
In a way that, like, It makes sense that I fell in with this group because I was like this beforehand.
They probably all were.
Yeah.
There's this great moment in your diary where I think you're talking with Anna about,
uh-huh,
her being surprised that you're in the 97th percentile on SATs.
Uh-huh.
Like, it really shows that, right? There is like this, like, all of you are like,
yeah,
so concerned with the intelligence. And
yeah.
Intelligence.
Well, no, but like, also, I think there's a subtle point of that anecdote that you might not have picked up on. Because, like, it's where, like, I, you know, she said she was surprised. I said she was I don't, but, like.
You were surprised that she was surprised.
Right. But, like, she, and then she was, like, you should expect, like, there, sorry, I don't have the text in front of me, but there's this, like, deep, that last thing she said of, like, you should have expected me to be surprised given that, like, there's this deep Bayesian, I don't know how to articulate it in words in real time. If I had, see, this is what's so frustrating about journalists who like prefer to talk in real time, is that like, I'm so much dumber. Okay, speaking of obsession with intelligence, I'm so much dumber in real time, like having a live conversation. Where's, yeah, but like, that's why you like it. Okay. Because it's faster.
We're dumber in some ways, we're smarter in others.
Okay.
We can go back and forth. And
okay.
You can correct yourself. And you can, you know, you can respond to what I've said. And,
uh-huh,
you can't do that on the page. Right?
Yeah. But like on the page, like, I like text better because like when you have like full minutes or even hours to think, you can like actually get it right.
Well, a lot of people in that community are probably,
yeah,
like that too. Scott Alexander told me he wouldn't want to meet with me.
Yeah.
Right? He wanted it all to be in email.
Yeah.
And there's a control there.
There's a thing that I can't describe verbally, but I could describe if I spent 15 minutes thinking about it and then writing about it.
Of
the thing that Anna was doing there was like, it ex- like intuitive expression of Bayesian reasoning. Or like,
I like that. Okay. And the other one, you know, like I said, there's when you show up at that group house in 2008 after the Singularity Summit in San Jose.
Yeah.
And you go and you guys are talking, and then the Singularity comes up.
Yeah.
And the way I think about it is that the sequences weren't about X risk and the Singularity and AI.
Uh-huh.
But that is on everybody's mind because that's on Minkowski's mind. Like, he's yeah. thinking about that for years. And,
yeah.
You know.
Well, so, like, the sequences were sort of like, you know, it's sort of a, like, propaganda move of, like, I'm going to teach you how to think. And, like, part of the reason I'm motivated to teach you how to think is because, like, some fraction of those people will be interested in my, will be recruitable for my singularity thing.
Yeah.
And he was very explicit about this.
He was.
Decision theory where, because among academics who have written about decision theory, there's this question of, you know, how would you make decisions in scenarios where like other agents can predict what you would do? So the motivating example was Newcomb's problem, where it's like you get to choose two boxes, yeah. And like what I mean, have you covered this already?
Wrote it in my book. Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, so I don't need to explain Newcomb's problem, but like basically, there's this idea of like if you're using causal decision theory, you might reason like, well, you know, the $1,000 is already in the second box or not. Therefore, I can just take the box because it's already there. My decision doesn't affect it. And then Yudkowsky is saying, no, this is wrong because like actually you are in an instantiation of a decision algorithm such that if you are the sort of person who would take the second box, the predictor has already taken that into account and the box will be empty for you.
So basically what he's saying is we might be in a simulation.
Yeah, well,
right. I mean, how else does that work unless we're in a simulation?
You don't necessarily have to be in the simulation. It's just that, like, if someone else can predict, if some other agency can predict you sufficiently well, it doesn't matter if their prediction itself is a simulation. But if the prediction is accurate, that's still enough to make the Newcomb's thing work. And like, there's a Nate Sorries even has a blog post about like Newcomb problems are common in real life, which argues that like people sort of do like you can to the extent that people are good judges of character, and you can say this person is someone I can trust. Like that is a kind of timeless decision theory of like. You're not, you know, I can trust you to make a deal because I know that you won't betray me even when it will be in your interest. It would be in your interest to suddenly betray me when you could get away with it. But because I know you, the fact that I know that if I can predict that you won't do that, that's why I'm willing to trust you in the first place.
Yeah, but we all know no one can really predict the future. And there's always a chance that...
Yeah, there's a chance, but like if probabilistic, like if you can do a good enough job, that can still be enough in some scenarios. If I can, like probabilistically predict that you probably won't betray me, then depending on the exact probabilities and utilities involved, like that might be enough for me to trust you. And so, the smart version of this idea for futurism is imagining that like. You know, if you have like super intelligences that originated in different parts of the universe or in like different branches of the universal wave function that like care about somehow, this is kind of weird. This is a weird, mostly irrelevant philosophy thing. But if you have super intelligence that emerged in different parts of the universe that like value different things and somehow the options that they have are calibrated such that like, you know, we're in separate universes, we can't actually interact, but, like, I really, really like making blue things, and you really, really like making green things. You could imagine, like, them making a deal such that, like, I make some green things in my universe. Or, like, I compute, like, you compute a trade deal without actually communicating, but just predicting what trade offers the other party would accept. And so I make some green things in my universe, and you make some blue things in your universe. And so, like, there's gains from trade without actually communicating, but just by predicting which trades the other party would accept if you could communicate. And so...
the other possibilities were limited, second
edition. I mean, yes. Yeah, like, some possible implementations of this idea might involve simulations, but, like, the decision theory isn't actually about that.
Yeah, I mean, these such interesting ideas.
Yeah.
You do wonder, like, how much of this really applies to reality, right?
Yeah, the stuff about a causal trade was very much an abstract philosophy thing, and not like a "we need to write this code right now" thing.
No, it's true. A lot of this seems like abstract philosophy. And
right.
I'm interested. I was interested in the essay that Yudkowsky wrote when he created Less Wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about what it is and mm-hmm. what rationality is. At one point, he says, "You know, Bayesian reasoning doesn't really work in the real world. Like the math just can't calculate it."
At yeah.
all. And that's kind of true. Like, as much as everybody's talking about Bayesian reasoning and you know, this mathematical thought, it doesn't really work.
Well, so the analogy, so you've probably already seen this analogy, but like, you know, if you're trying to catch a baseball, the way that you actually do it in practice is not by like solving the equations of motion in your head. And yet, Newtonian physics is still pretty useful. We still kind of want some educated people to know this stuff. It's very much the same thing with Bayesianism, where like, okay, you're not going to explicitly use Bayes' theorem to do the cognitive equivalent of catching a baseball, but like, in principle, this is like the governing law.
Super, super interesting. It is about the ideas. Like the ideas
okay.
are,
yeah.
But so I appreciate you talking to me about all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I wish Ben would too, but it's prerogative not to.
I mean, he specifically said it's not like I think if you had impressed him more, he might have. Like, I don't think it was unconditional.
No, I get it.
Yeah.
I mean, but I told him, you know.
Yeah.
Well, like, the truth.
And yeah.
If he doesn't want to go for that, it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, he's busy. He has two kids.
Sure.
They're like, you know, one, like, there's a toddler and, like, a 9-month-old baby, I think, now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Do you have this notion of hyperstition?
Yeah, I've heard the term.
Yeah. It's something that I think about a lot. Like, the community
uh-huh.
has sort of brought about the thing that it feared.
Yeah, that we're pretty sad about that. People have noticed this and are kind of sad about it.
Right, yeah. How do you think about that?
I mean, so like... there is... I mean, the world was going to build AI at some point anyway. So if talking about these like galaxy brained ideas about human extinction and like transhumanism and the singular, like if talking about it made it happen sooner, but also made society better prepared, that might be a better trade. That might be a worthwhile trade off rather than it happening a little bit later, but like no one, but like it taking people by surprise, even more by surprise because intellectuals refuse to talk about it.
Sure. But isn't there a really good argument made though that like the race we're in now is what's really dangerous, and that's
why like Yudkowsky and Soares have like said like you know, creating. I mean, there was a part where, like, there was this weird thing where, like, when OpenAI was announced, like, Sori is, like, posted on the Miri blog, like,
said he was excited.
Yeah, and, like, privately, he has a rationalization of why that was, like, not technically lying, but, like, functionally, that's a lie. Like,
do you think he was purposefully lying in the moment?
He was, like, trying to, again, like, I don't have insider knowledge here. This is just my understanding from, like, gossip channels and stuff. But, like, he didn't feel comfortable, like, saying in public, this sounds like a horrible idea. What the hell are you guys doing? This is terrible. He felt like that would not be, because, you know, there was so much money and power behind this OpenAI thing that he didn't feel comfortable criticizing in public at that time. I mean, it's probably on his Twitter somewhere, but, like, Yudkowsky said somewhere that, like, he cried at the OpenAI announcement.
But it is interesting, like, you know, separately, Paul Cristiano and Dario Amodei.
Yeah.
They were actually in talks with those guys, okay? And they didn't join the lab.
Mm-hmm.
But then they joined a little bit later.
Uh-huh.
You know, it seems because they wanted to, like, change the culture. And, you know,
yeah.
OpenPhil came in with $30 million.
Yeah. Speaking of Ben Hoffman, like, he had a post about, like, an OpenAI board seat is surprisingly expensive.
You said at the time, or was it?
It was contemporaneous, yeah.
Dude, it was?
Yeah. Where, like, I'll send you the link later.
I'd love to see that work. That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah. Because it's funny, just nowadays that crowd, they sort of deny that they did all this, but it's just all there on the internet. It's just like, you know, we're making this donation.
Uh-huh.
We get the 2 board seats.
Yeah.
We're going to oversee AI safety. It's really...
They thought they could exert more control than they ended up exerting.
Yeah, yeah. And it has, in the end, it has the opposite effect. Again,
yeah.
So interesting.
But, I mean, like, Cristiano has written somewhere that, like, he didn't think, like, an equilibrium of DeepMind is the only one who works on AGI forever. Like, he didn't think that was stable anyway.
But I don't know. I really question this idea that this is going to be built no matter what. So we're going to build it.
Well, so that, I mean, like, Yudkowsky has changed his mind about this. Like, there's the book coming out in September of, like, if anyone builds it, everyone dies. That's, like, lobbying for an international treaty to not build it.
True.
And so, I mean, nowadays the plan is let's somehow get government, you know, our only hope, this probably won't work, but our only hope is to get governments to make people not build it.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the Anthropic philosophy where we're going to build it and create this race to the top they talk about. Like, you know.
Well,
what they did is they came into OpenAI.
Yeah.
And then they scaled it up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were the ones that scaled it up. It's not like anybody else was. They scaled it up.
Mm-hmm.
And their argument is you got to be working on the technology to do safety. And,
mm-hmm.
But.
I'm kind of sympathetic to that.
Tell me why.
Because, like, if we don't, like, the logic of if we don't do it, someone else will, like, it, I think it's true on some time scale. Like, if we don't do it, like, someone else might not do it immediately, but, like, as time goes on and economic growth continues and people, like, eventually someone is going to get around to it. And so, like, the idea of, like, okay, we foresighted people are going to, like, do what we can to, like, take leadership in, like, doing this in the most responsible way that we can. Like, I won't necessarily say I'm not going to necessarily full-throatedly agree, but, like, it doesn't seem like an entirely crazy thing to think or try.
It does seem like the sort of classic argument between free will and determinism. Like, it's like, you know, it's this, like, very deterministic,
yeah,
you know, stand. It's going to happen no matter what, and so we might as well do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think it's one way to see
it's like a little form of
see the world.
Uh-huh.
But
no, because it's part of one
of the I don't know. I think there's another way to look at it. Is that fair?
What is the other way?
That if you scale this thing up as quick as you can, you're creating a lot of the problems that you sought to avoid.
Yes. Yeah.
We'll see how it all plays out.
Yep.
Have you read Yukowski's book?
No, it's not published yet, and I am not on the pre-readers list.
The other thing is that I think the other reason that they're scaling it up and, you know, continue to push for this is they think it's going to bring utopia, right?
Yeah.
It's
like
that's the flip side. It's like there's flip side that's where they're worried about destruction, but what they really, you know.
Well, because
really
the LLMs are already, like, economically useful. I do use these things all the time.
It's different from it, like, solving world peace and curing cancer. And all, right? Everybody thinks that. So they're sort of striving for this, you know, utopia, but worried about destruction. It's like it's just like biblical.
Yeah, pretty much.
But it's not a religion.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That might be like the end of the book. That sort of sums it up. Okay, one other thing, because I, you know, you pointed to that thing from Skylar's Laser, where he sums up what rationality is, like I talked about before, and you talked about it as like joking, but not. I think that's right. Like it's.
I don't remember which thing you're talking.
Where he says, "What are the rationalists really? You know, they have
the belief that Eliezer Yudkowsky is the rightful caliph."
Exactly. I mean, that's. I think you sum it up well. It's true. Sort of a joke.
That's why I got so mad and like wait and like spent the last 9 years of my life trying to fix this stupid cult is that like I actually believed that Eliezer Yudkowsky was the rightful caliph, and then it turns out like he's not interested in living up to that standard because it would be politically inconvenient and. When you're trying to run a nonprofit in Berkeley.
So that was the way the community worked, but the caliph wasn't standing up for what he should have been.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
I mean, and like maybe, like, you know, it's possible that was like the right decision from an existential risk management perspective of like, let's not venture. I mean, as you've noticed, that like a lot of people around here are eager to like talk about everything, including all the heresies. But like the leadership isn't going to like be serious like free speech, free inquiry maximalists. And like maybe that's the right decision from an existential risk management thing. But I think if you're going to do that, you should be humble. You should be humble about like not. Insinuating that you and your flunkies are the only sane people in the world. And so that's why, so in part four, the end of part four of my memoir, I talk about this very explicitly. I'm not really, like, I also think Scott is being pretty dishonest for political reasons. I think he's less self-aware about it than Yudkowsky. That's just my read. I'm not a mind reader, but that's my read of the situation. But I have a lot less personal, I feel much less personally aggrieved at Scott precisely because Scott is so humble. Like, he's not, like, he writes a blog. A lot of people read the blog. But he's not expecting people to defer to him as an authority figure. He's just like, I write a blog. I'm just a guy who writes a blog. And Yudkowsky is, like, does not identify as, like, I'm just a guy who writes the blog. He's like, I am the only sane person on Earth. And he doesn't, you know... The sequences were so good that, like, I actually thought the screen was credible at the time. It really did seem credible at the time. And he just does not seem interested in living up to this these days. Or even, like, noticing... I'm not sure how, like... To this day, I am not sure to what extent he is being consciously dishonest versus has fallen into self-delusion, but it's...
Well, last thing, on the consciously dishonest front, like, people have talked about this. You linked to that blog post that talks about, you know... Did they say EA has a lying problem, or is it the whole community has a lying problem?
It was EA has a lying problem, was the post.
And so people talk about that. Like, it's like everything is in service of this X-risk thing. And so lying becomes okay, but or undermine your values in other ways becomes okay because you're saving the world. Like, how real is that?
I mean... I think there are people who are falling into that failure mode, and there are also other people who are criticizing them for that. So, like, both those things can happen at the same time, because, like, again, we talk about the movement as an abstracted thing, but, like, it's actually, like, thousands of different people who happen to read the same stuff. And so, like, some of them are more honest than others, and some of them are less honest than others. And some of them are true believers, and some of them, and so, like, Sam Bankman-Fried, you know, as of 2021, everyone would agree, Sam Bankman-Fried, oh, he's an effective altruist. Like, he's totally one of us. And then afterwards, we're like, wait, he shouldn't count.
It's like anyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyone who missteps.
Yeah.
Zizians, they're not part of it.
Yeah.
Sam Bankman-Fried, leverage, all that stuff, not part of it.
Yeah.
I mean... I don't know. When you have enough evidence, there might be a problem with the extreme.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Honestly, it's hugely helpful.
Yeah.
I might come back to you with like a couple things where you were elected to talk, but if you might write it down, like if you wrote down what you meant about Anna Solomon's response.
Yeah, I would. So, in general. I mean, I'm happy to talk because I'm happy to talk to anyone, but, like, just in terms of maximizing accuracy for the book and, like, not doing the thing you did to Kelsey Piper, like, I would prefer email just because, like, I can think carefully and write the exact paragraph that expresses exactly the thing, whereas, like, in real time, I'm just, like...
I can give you like a list of facts.
Yeah, if you give me a huge list of facts, I can go line by line and like be very, very precise.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then,
when is this coming out?
We'll see. Sometimes it's hard to tell with the book publishing.
Yeah.
So I'll keep that.
Okay.
What's your impression of what Roos is doing with this community?
I don't know the details. Basically, I just... Sorry, I mentioned... Like, the reason I mentioned to him is because, like, you both work for the New York Times, so it's a conversation... I've read a few of his articles, I listened to a couple podcast episodes, and I happened to see him at Less Online. That's all I know. I don't actually know anything.
Fantastic. Thank you, as always.
Okay, thanks.